Let's start with what is your musical background?
Well, my musical background is that I started taking piano lessons when I was about 5 and a half, 6 years old. And I started, my mom was a trained classical pianist, but not professional. And she wanted me to take what was called popular piano, which meant not classical music, which meant basically improvisation. So I started learning how to play my own arrangements of tunes and of jazz when I was very young. I did that for most of my life. When I got into college, I ended up being an art major. I never was a music major, and I never really formally studied in any conservatory, but I just kept picking up more and more musical information just out of my own curiosity as the years went by and as I needed it. So it's sort of an untraditional music education, to say the least.
All right. Well, what is the first thing you do when beginning to write a score?
I think the first thing I do, well, after talking to the director and the producer and making sure everybody is sort of on the same stylistic page, the first thing I do is create a palette. So I think the sound of each score is what's really important, and I think it's great as an artist to limit myself in terms of what I can do and what I can't do. I think that really helps creativity. So if I see a movie, I'll go, well, this movie feels like these kind of instruments, this kind of groove, this kind of musical take from this period, or this movie, melodic, not melodic, percussive, orchestral, electronic. But I'll pick out what's similar to a color palette. And that's usually the very first thing I do. And then after I've done that, I start playing around on the piano. And I still like using a real piano before I sit down at the synthesizers. And just start picking out some themes or some ideas or rhythms. So it's starting, that's sort of where you start. I love limiting myself to a certain color, a certain style of music on each film. And that way each film comes out a bit differently than the other ones. And it keeps me a lot more interested in my work, actually.
I noticed that you kind of refer to music as in colors. And so is the artistic background kind of a helping you with your scoring process?
I think it has. I mean, I was always a really good visual artist and painted and drew my whole life. And like I said, that was actually my major at university, was fine arts. Mm-hmm. So I do, I don't know if I think of it literally in color, but I do think of a palette, that there's a musical palette, in the same way that you could say, well, Picasso in his blue period painted with blue colors. And that, you know, I mean, that's a pretty simplistic view, but there is definitely a musical palette, and that can be put to great use on a film, because it gives a specificity to the film that it's nice when the music has that sort of focus.
Okay. So now, when you're given a project, let's say, well, since we are going to be talking about the Last Starfighter,
sure,
let's use that as an example. When you were given the Last Starfighter, were you told just to go compose and bring me something back, or how involved was the director?
The director is a very close friend of mine, Nick Castle, and was very involved, and also, quite often, the producer and the studio are involved too, because they all have voices. And if you end up in a situation where they're each thinking of a totally different kind of music, which has happened to me, and I'm sure every composer, the end is usually disastrous. But that happens, where like the producer thinks he's getting John Williams and the director thinks he's getting Penderecki, and you know, and nobody's talking to everybody to anybody. So the first thing is, with Starfighter, was the realization, this was in the 80s, it was coming off Star Wars and those kind of movies, and there was really no way to move too far away from that late romantic orchestra. It felt right into that tradition, and at that time to have said, well, I want to score this all electronically, or I wanted to score this with a little band, would just not have made sense and what would have happened, they might have said yes, and then they would have thrown out the score and hired another composer. So I knew from the really beginning that this was going to be a romantic score. In terms of the palette, what I really tried to do was say, well, how can I distinguish myself from, at the time, John Williams and right. that sort of sound, and yet be true to that late romantic sound? I mean, after all, he wrote that based on the temp track of Star Wars, which was Hulse Planets. Mm-hmm. So that's where he came from. And he had to find a way to make it his, which he did. But you can still hear the influence, of course. I took that same approach and said, well, how can I make this different? I can tell you the various ways I did if you want to hear them. But that was the approach. So I knew that this was going to be a big orchestra, that they were willing to pay for a big orchestra, and you know, that was what was going to happen.
Okay. So what influenced instrument choice?
A romantic orchestra is a pretty set group of instruments. Mm-hmm. The only thing is how big is it? So if you take early romantic writing, you're still probably with double woodwinds and two or three French horns. If you get a little later, you get to four and three woodwinds. But when you get all the way to Mahler, you get to four woodwinds called quadruple woodwinds, and you get to six horns and six trumpets, and you get these behemoth orchestras. And so I thought, well, let's do that. Since if they're willing to pay for it, sounds like fun. And it isn't every day that they're going to pop for that big of an orchestra, but they were willing on this. So the instrumentation was traditionally a romantic orchestra, which is basically a beefed up classical orchestra, but beefed up to the max. To that, I added a couple of synthesizer players, which obviously was not in Star Wars. There were no synthesizers. Mm-hmm. And made that a major part of the sound. It's used in most of the cues at some point. It's rarely up front, but it is occasionally. So if you listen to the music of the sort of bad guys theme, those low notes, those are all big giant analog synthesizers doing that, probably along with the tuba and some low strings. If you listen to the main theme, the synthesizers are more in the background, but they're a lot of the shimmering effects that you get on top of the orchestra. And where you hear it quite a bit, actually, is in there's a character that was played by Robert Preston called Centauri.
Yes.
And I used what's called an iwi, which is an electronic woodwind instrument, which is an instrument that is played exactly like a clarinet in that it has the fingering and the mouthpiece and the whole bit, but it's triggering synthesizers. There's no reed. And so I used that for Centauri's theme and was able to come up with this sort of, I always saw him as a snake charmer, and I think part of it was that I just had always loved Robert Preston ever since he starred in The Music Man. He was such a great musical comedy figure. Thought of him as the shuck and jive salesman, so I tried to make it sound like an electronic version of a snake charmer's instrument.
Okay.
And that's very electronic.
Okay.
So those were sort of the color moments that the synthesizers brought.
All right. Well, just going to go back just for
sure.
How first of all, how did you become involved with The Last Starfighter?
I had done Nick Castle's first movie, which was called Tag, The Assassination Game, with Linda Hamilton. It was a low-budget film. And we just got along great. He loved the score I did. And when he got The Last Starfighter, I was his choice and made it through the gauntlet of the studio and the producer and was the composer.
Okay.
It's that simple.
All right. Now, because the film did have some of the cutting-edge computer graphics and that sort of thing, did you feel that you had to bring your A-game to the score?
Well, first of all, you always bring your A-game to the score.
Of course.
I don't think you can make a living doing this. But the answer to the question is that it was very influential. It influenced my score quite a bit because, first of all, this was the first completely CGI film. Mm-hmm. Tron just had a few little moments that were CGI. This was everything, all the spaceships, all everything you see is CGI, and it's become like a landmark for all the geeks who are into CGI. When I scored it, though, because it was so new, I had to score it imagining what it was going to look like. So I might look at the film and see a black screen with a little dot moving slowly across it and another dot moving in another direction, and then it would have to be explained to me, this is the giant warship and this is this and this is and none of it was there. It was literally a black screen with white dots, and you're going, to this I have to write the big bombastic gigantic over the top music, which of course doesn't fit a black dot in a white screen.
Of
you know
course,
you think
yes.
you do that with a little piano or something, but you just sort of go for it. So it wasn't until I was well into scoring that I started seeing these. And in those days, because it was very early computer, they had to invent a ton of this stuff that we take for granted. And they were also using a giant Cray computer, which was basically a whole floor of a building submerged in water to cool it.
Wow.
And as one of the guys who was one of the CGI guys mentioned, he said, you know, you have more power in your iPhone than we had in our entire computer. So you'd get it layer by layer. So you might get a little more rendering. They'd look at that, okay, that. Then they'd add a little atmosphere. Then they'd add another level of atmosphere. Then they'd add another level of metallic shine. It's done layer by layer by layer by layer, the computer graphics. And that's how it was rendered in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of an interesting subject in and of itself. But I had to write the music to this almost imaginary thing that then started looking cartoony, and then finally ended up, at least for the time, looking pretty good. You know, now when you look at it, it looks quaint, because now you could probably do it on your home computer. But but then, I mean, it was you were talking about mainframe computer.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. So, when you're talking synthesizers for your score,
mm-hmm.
Back then, what kind of synthesizers are we talking about for that kind of score? And did you feel that those were kind of necessary because of the CGI nature of the special effects?
No, that isn't why I felt they were necessary. In university, I did a lot of music, even though I wasn't a music major. And one thing I mm-hmm. did was I got myself into the electronic music laboratories. And that was pre-computer, so it was all like these wires that you'd connect to oscillators and filters and ring modulators. And so I got very into electronic music when I was really like 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so from really the very beginning that I started my film music career, I was trying to incorporate synthesizers. It just seemed like a natural thing to do with this. It also, as I said, felt like something I could do that was a little more unique rather than just the orchestra. The kinds of synthesizers, I can't remember exactly the kind. They were probably DX7s and earlier synthesizers. They were all played live. And so even the little programmed bits, like the sparkly stuff,
mm-hmm.
Nothing was pre-recorded. It was all some of it was programmed and triggered by clicks, which in and of itself was quite a technical feat at the time.
Right.
But it was so fast you couldn't play it, the stuff that I had written.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was mixed live with the orchestra. And there were two synthesizer players, and they were in the room with the orchestra. And mixed right in with the orchestra sounds, which never happened today.
So. Right, so we're not talking like a MIDI system or anything like that.
There was no MIDI. And, maybe there was MIDI, you know? No, I don't think there was. So they were played live. Now, even right after that, I did a movie called Remo Williams, and that was a combination of a big orchestra, 24 tracks of electronics, and a Korean orchestra. But we were on multi-track tape, so we spent a week just laying down all the synth tracks and then overdubbed the full orchestra, then overdubbed the Korean instruments. That's more the way it's done now, where you know, where you do it bit by bit. But
right.
I wanted to do it all live, and that was sort of the way this worked out.
Right. So,
and you get an energy that way too.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool
for sure. So now, how do you present it back then? How did you present your score to the director? Was it on tape, or you know, I guess there really wasn't anything like a today.
It's funny to think about this, but up to really not that long ago, people had to have imagination, and so you'd have to literally say to your director and producer, okay, here's the melody, but you have to imagine this played by six trumpets. And here's this rhythm, but it's really like all these horns and strings, and then here's where the timpani's come in. You don't have to sort of put on a show, because
right.
There was no way to mock anything up. Now everything, of course, is mocked up, and
exactly.
I think a lot of times recording the orchestra is not even necessary because the mock-ups are so realistic. But back then, you know, and honestly, for most of the history of film music, there was no such thing as mock-ups.
Exactly.
Or even temp tracks. Temp tracks were very rare, only done on occasion, because they were very time-consuming and difficult to do.
Mm.
So people really had to use their imagination. On the other hand, it made it much more of a dangerous game, because the first time they would hear it would be in the recording studio with the clock ticking, with, you know, a 100-piece orchestra, studio fees, all the technical people, and the producers and directors and studio people would have to make very quick judgments if they liked what was going on or not. So it was horrible, because you didn't know if they really understood what you were talking about. I mean, I can look at a score and understand what it sounds like, but most people, of course, couldn't. So it was always the first day of scoring is always just like really, really difficult, because I don't think there was any way most people could imagine what it was really going to sound like.
Okay.
No matter how hard they tried.
Right.